Welcome to the History Maps podcast. Standing on the walls of the port city of Sirium, in the pitch black of a monsoon downpour, the defenders are completely outnumbered.
Right.
They're relying on heavy artillery and, you know, French mercenaries to hold back this relentless inland army. The rain is blinding. The noise outside the walls is deafening, just drums and gongs echoing through the storm.
Yeah.
And then out of the darkness, 93 men covered in hardened lacquer scale those sheer walls, and they engage in brutal hand-to-hand combat that will ultimately break a 14-month siege and seal the fate of an entire civilization.
It's a highly pivotal moment.
It really is. Today, we're taking a comprehensive deep dive into the sources you sent over regarding the Hanthawaddy Kingdom. This was a massive powerhouse of Southeast Asian history that ruled Lower Burma, which is present-day Myanmar, holding power from 1287 to 1539, and then experiencing a brief but highly volatile resurrection from 1740 to 1757.
The primary mission for this analysis is to thoroughly understand the structural life cycle of this Mon-speaking kingdom. We're going to examine its cyclic rise, its prolonged golden age, and, well, its ultimate total destruction.
Right.
We'll be looking specifically at how riverine geography, international maritime trade, and the really delicate nature of internal political cohesion shaped its destiny against the relentless demographic and military pressure of those northern inland powers.
And to do this, we're synthesizing a vast array of historical documentation that you provided. So we're looking at historical chronicles like the Mahayazawan and the Razaderide Dauban, alongside modern historical analyses of, you know, Southeast Asian state building, demographic shifts, and asymmetric warfare.
Yeah, it's a highly complex geopolitical canvas.
Very much so. So to anchor ourselves, we need to begin in the late 13th century. If you look at the geopolitical map of the Irrawaddy Valley prior to 1287, you see the pagan empire.
Right. They were the first entity to actually unify this massive geographic corridor.
But then Kublai Khan's Mongol armies invade from the north. The pagan empire just shatters, and the Burman king is driven completely from his throne.
And that event triggers a massive systemic power vacuum. I mean, when the central authority of pagan collapses in 1287, it initiates a period of political fragmentation that lasts for over 250 years.
Two and a half centuries.
Exactly. The geopolitical gravity of the entire region just dissolves. In the northern and eastern arcs, you have Shan settlers moving down from the highlands, establishing their own fortified principalities.
Right.
The central dry zone becomes this patchwork of competing petty kingdoms. But if you look to the south, toward the coastal regions, a completely different political ecosystem begins to emerge.
Right, because in 1287, a leader named King Waru founds the Hanthawaddy Kingdom, which was initially recorded as Ramanya Desa, right?
Yes. And at its inception, it operates as a nominal vassal to two major external powers, the Sukhothai Kingdom to the east and the Mongol Yuan Dynasty to the north.
But they don't remain a vassal state for long.
No, they don't.
The documentation shows that by 1330, Hanthawaddy becomes formally independent. However, this early kingdom is not like a monolithic empire. It's described as a loose federation of three distinct regional power centers.
Right.
You have the Irrawaddy Delta in the west, Bago or Pegu in the center, and Matama, also known as Martaban, in the east.
And understanding that tripartite structure is essential to understanding the entire trajectory of the Hanthawaddy state. Their power was fundamentally derived from water, but in two very different ways.
Okay, how so?
First, you have the Irrawaddy Delta. This region provided immense agricultural surpluses through wet rice cultivation. Now, wet rice farming requires highly organized labor to manage the water tables, but the caloric yield per acre is just massive.
Well, it feeds a lot of people.
Exactly. It creates highly dense localized populations. Second, you have their coastal ports. These ports connected them directly to the vast, lucrative maritime trade networks of the Indian Ocean.
Which means money.
Tons of it. They were generating immense wealth from foreign commerce while simultaneously sitting on the most productive agricultural land in the region.
So if you look at the economic data provided, they essentially had an endless supply of food and an endless supply of foreign currency.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. If they had the wealth of the sea and the food of the delta, why were they so politically fragile during these early decades?
That's the core question.
Right. Like, if you have that much wealth and demographic potential, why remain a loose, fractured federation? Was this merely a failure of dynastic leadership, or was there a structural mechanism keeping them divided?
It was overwhelmingly structural. It was dictated by the geography itself. Ruling the Irrawaddy Delta in the 13th and 14th centuries was like I mean, it was like trying to hold water in your bare hands.
Because of the rivers.
Yeah, it's a sprawling, highly complex network of shifting tidal rivers, mangrove swamps, and floodplains. Trying to project centralized military force across that terrain is a total logistical nightmare.
Especially during the rains.
Precisely. When the monsoon season hits, the waterways flood, and every local warlord or regional governor suddenly has an impassable moat isolating them from the central army in Pegu.
Right.
So that specific geography naturally fostered the rise of highly independent, semi-autonomous lords who controlled their own specific river networks and, crucially, collected their own tolls.
You can clearly see that regional autonomy when you examine a city like Martaban.
Mm.
The descriptions of Martaban in this era depict a bustling, deeply cosmopolitan port.
Very cosmopolitan.
You have Hmong craftsmen, Indian merchants from across the Bay of Bengal, and Thai emissaries conducting diplomacy. It was entirely outward-looking, oriented toward the sea.
Which contrasts sharply with the agrarian, landlocked focus of the northern Burmese states. Martaban operated almost like an independent city-state.
Even the founder of the kingdom, Weru, whose original name was Magadu, was a time-honored adventurer, right?
Yeah, he had fled the Sukhothai court to establish his own domain on the coast. His authority was built entirely on controlling the physical flow of maritime goods. He understood the fundamental economic reality of the region. Whoever controls the port customs controls the hard currency.
Right. But because the kingdom was distributed across those three distinct provinces, the Delta, Pegu, and Martaban, the wealth was decentralized.
Exactly. The regional lords possessed enough independent wealth to routinely ignore the central king in Pegu.
Which creates a highly volatile baseline for the kingdom. This fragile federation of three wealthy but fiercely independent provinces sets the stage for a severe internal crisis.
A crisis that forces the issue of centralization, yeah.
And it begins in 1384, centering on a 16-year-old boy.
That boy is Rezadarit. In 1384, at 16 years of age, he claims the throne. But he does not inherit a peaceful transition of power. He takes control only after actively rebelling against his own ailing father, King Binyayu. When he assumes the title, his actual authority barely extends beyond the immediate perimeter of the Pegu province.
His realm is heavily fractured. His major vassals entirely reject his legitimacy. And crucially, these insubordinate vassals include his own uncles, who serve as the viceroys of the highly lucrative Myeongmya and Martaban provinces.
Family politics at its most dangerous.
Right. And one of these uncles, Viceroy Lokpia of Myeongmya, takes his defiance a step further. He actively sends correspondents to the northern Ava kingdom, explicitly inviting them to invade the south and depose his 16-year-old nephew.
And that single invitation alters the geopolitical trajectory of the entire region. But before the northern armies can fully mobilize, Rezadar has to survive his own family. Through a combination of rapid military mobilization and a highly calculated political strategy, this teenager survives the initial Ava incursions and then methodically turns on his uncles. By 1390, just 6 years later, he has completely conquered and reunified the three Mon provinces under his absolute control.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Rezadarit is essentially playing a massive game of geopolitical chess. But he's starting with only his king and a few pawns while his opponents have all their major pieces.
Yeah.
Yet he tricks them into fighting each other or waiting too long. How exactly does a 16-year-old, isolated in one province, defeat established regional lords who have the backing of a major foreign power?
Well, we have to look at the demographic and geographic advantages embedded in his specific starting position. Rezadarit controlled the Pegu-Dagan-Sirium corridor.
Okay.
If you analyze the agricultural output and settlement pattern of the time, this specific corridor was the most densely populated and agriculturally stable region of the south. He possessed a fundamental demographic trump card.
More people.
Exactly. He could conscript and field a larger army than his uncles, provided he could protect his core territory during those initial assaults.
And his uncles commit massive strategic errors by failing to coordinate. You noted in the research that their interests were deeply misaligned.
Highly misaligned. Yeah.
Lokpia in the Delta wanted the northern Ava armies to intervene so he could seize the central throne. But his brother Biadaba, who controlled the wealth of Martaban, viewed Ava as an existential threat to his maritime independence.
Right.
They completely failed to form a unified front.
And that lack of coordination provided Rezadarit with the exact tactical window he needed. he utilized interior lines of communication to defeat them piecemeal.
One by one.
Exactly. He would isolate one uncle's forces, overwhelm them with his demographic advantage, and then pivot to the next. But this crucible of isolation and familial betrayal fundamentally rewired his approach to governance.
He became quite brutal.
He developed a highly ruthless political methodology. Upon securing power, he immediately executed any potential dynastic rivals, including his own half-brothers. His entire administration was built on the premise of absolute unquestioned loyalty, enforced by immediate lethal consequences.
There is a specific historical account regarding his first wife, Da, that perfectly illustrates the psychological toll of this ruthlessness.
Yeah, that's a tough one to read.
It is. After Razadart successfully unifies the kingdom, he holds a grand second coronation in 1390 to formalize his absolute rule. During this ceremony, he elevates a different woman, Pia Yazadewi, to the position of chief queen.
Right.
But he doesn't just politically demote his first wife, Da. He forces her to hand over her family heirlooms, specifically a dozen rings given to her by their father, the late King Binyayu, and he publicly gives those rings to the new chief queen.
And the rings were not merely jewelry, they were physical symbols of dynastic continuity and legitimacy. By stripping them from Da, he was publicly severing her connection to the royal lineage and demonstrating his absolute authority to reassign status at will. The accounts record that Da, thoroughly humiliated and stripped of her identity, committed suicide shortly after.
It's a stark demonstration of how Razadurit viewed human relationships. Every personal tie was subordinate to the absolute projection of his centralized power.
He essentially treats the political landscape like a complex mechanical system. He starts with a severe disadvantage in parts, but because he understands the geography and the flaws in his opponent's alliances, he isolates the components, strips their gears, and completely rebuilds the machine under his own control.
He successfully centralized the Hathawati state, eliminated the regional warlords, and established a loyal administrative cadre. But a much larger threat was looming.
Right, because he had secured the south, but he could not undo the diplomatic invitation his uncle Lokpia had sent to the north.
The northern kingdom of Ava was coming.
The kingdom of Ava was definitely mobilizing for a massive southward expansion,
which initiates the 40 Years' War. This conflict spans from 1385 to 1424. We are looking at a generation-defining total war between the Mon-speaking Hathawati kingdom in the south and the Burmese-speaking Ava kingdom in the north.
And the ideological driver for Ava was restoration. The kings of Ava, specifically Swasake, later Minkong, and his son, Crown Prince Minikiaswa, they viewed themselves as the legitimate heirs to the shattered pagan empire.
Okay, so they wanted to rebuild.
Right. Their grand strategic objective was to reconstruct that unified state. And to achieve that, they absolutely required the wealth of the south. They needed control of the maritime ports to access foreign firearms and luxury goods.
And the food.
And the food, yes. They needed the vast rice surpluses of the Irrawaddy Delta to sustain their growing population and military apparatus.
The logistics and scale of this conflict are just immense. The documentation details massive riverine flotillas comprising hundreds of specialized warboats. You have thousands of war elephants utilized as heavy cavalry and prolonged, highly destructive sieges of fortified towns scattered across the delta.
Yeah.
At one point, in 1401, Razadarit actually reverses the momentum. He goes on the offensive.
He does.
He launches a massive naval offensive up the Irrawaddy River, cutting right into Ava's heartland, and establishes a naval blockade of the Ava capital itself.
To understand how a war can last for four decades without a definitive victor, you really have to analyze the profound strategic asymmetries between the two militaries.
Right.
The Ava kingdom possessed deeply entrenched superiority in land warfare. They bordered the Shan states to the north and east, which provided them with a steady supply of high-quality horses and highly experienced cavalrymen.
So on land, they dominate.
On open terrain, Ava's heavy elephant corps and rapid cavalry were devastating.
But Hathawati controlled the rivers. They possessed highly advanced warboats, designed specifically for the shallow, shifting currents of the delta. Furthermore, their control of the coastal ports meant they held a monopoly on the importation of early firearms from maritime traders.
Right.
And they possessed the massive reserves of silver required to hire specialized foreign mercenaries.
So Ava dominated the land, and Hathawati dominated the water. And both sides engaged in complex proxy warfare to stretch the other's resources.
How so?
Well, Ava launched campaigns to the west to conquer Arakan, aiming to secure their flank and gain a coastal outlet. In response, Hanthawaddy established diplomatic channels with the powerful Shan state of Senwi in the north, and even sent envoys to Ming Dynasty China.
Oh, wow. Wait, Ming China?
Yeah, they successfully coordinated pressure on Ava's northern borders. They basically forced Ava into a highly draining two-front war.
So what does this all mean for the average person living through this? If you're a farmer in the Irrawaddy Delta, are you just seeing armies march back and forth for four decades? Or did these kings actually try to govern the lands they fought over?
For the civilian population, the reality was systematic devastation, and it was heavily dictated by the environmental cycle. The Southeast Asian monsoon season enforces strict limitations on military movement.
Because of the rain.
Right. Large armies could only maneuver and fight effectively during the dry season. When the monsoons arrived in late May, the entire delta transformed into a vast, flooded marshland. Armies bogged down in the mud would be decimated by malaria, dysentery, and supply shortages.
So the logistics of maintaining tens of thousands of troops hundreds of miles from their supply centers become the primary mechanism of the war.
Precisely. To solve the logistical nightmare, both armies utilized scorched earth tactics. They heavily requisitioned local rice stores, forcibly conscripted farmers to act as porters or infantry, and systematically burned villages.
Just to deny resources to the enemy.
Exactly. To deny safe harbor and resources to the enemy before retreating at the onset of the rains. The local population was treated merely as a highly expendable logistical resource.
And yet, parallel to this systemic destruction, the chronicles contain these deeply specific accounts of aristocratic chivalry.
Yeah, it's quite the paradox.
You read about formal single combat between opposing commanders. There are instances where generals actively spare each other's lives on the battlefield out of a stated respect for their martial prowess.
And you see this most clearly in their diplomatic interactions. Even while they were waging a total war of attrition, the royal houses remained deeply intertwined. Razadarit married King Minghong's sister, and Minghong married Razadarit's daughter.
While they were fighting to the death.
Exactly. The royal elites viewed themselves as part of a shared, highly exclusive fraternity. Their political objectives required the destruction of the opposing state apparatus, but they maintained strict cultural protocols regarding how royalty interacted with royalty.
That dynamic is perfectly illustrated during the 1401 naval blockade. Razadarit has sailed his massive armada hundreds of miles north. He completely controls the Irrawaddy River all the way to Tagum. He has the capital of Ava cut off from riverine supply lines. But he quickly realizes that naval supremacy cannot physically breach the thick, reinforced masonry walls of the city. He is stuck.
Yeah.
Inside the city, King Minghong knows he is trapped and needs to buy time until the river levels drop or reinforcements arrive.
And Minghong's solution relies entirely on their shared cultural framework. He does not send a military envoy. He sends a highly prominent, deeply venerated Buddhist monk out to the Hanthawaddy command ship to broker a temporary truce.
And Razadarit, despite having his enemy cornered, accepts the truce.
He does.
He respects the religious authority of the monk and agrees to withdraw his fleet downriver.
It highlights that despite the extreme violence of the 40 years of conflict, both sides operated within a shared religious and cultural paradigm. Theravada Buddhism provided an overriding framework that could, in specific moments, supersede strict military calculus.
But ultimately, this war does not conclude with a decisive empire-breaking battle. It ends through sheer systemic exhaustion.
Right. The two primary architects of the conflict simply die. Minghong passes away in 1421, and Razadarit dies the following year, in 1422, reportedly from a hunting accident.
And with their deaths, the institutional momentum for the war just collapses. Neither state possesses the manpower, the financial reserves, or the dynastic will to continue the campaigns.
The conclusion of the 40 Years' War radically diverges the paths of the two kingdoms. In the north, the Ava kingdom, severely weakened and devoid of its veteran leadership, begins to disintegrate under sustained, relentless pressure from the Shan states.
But in the south?
In the south, the cessation of hostilities allows the Hanthawaddy state to fully capitalize on its geographic advantages.
This marks the transition into the Hanthawaddy Golden Age, a century of profound stability spanning from roughly 1424 to 1534. Instead of pouring vast sums of silver into maintaining warboats and mercenary armies, Pegu channels its resources inward.
Yeah, it transforms into a highly prosperous, cosmopolitan epicenter of Theravada Buddhist scholarship and Indian Ocean maritime commerce.
The defining architect of this golden age is Queen Shinsabu, who reigned from 1454 to 1471. She holds the distinction of being the only female regent in the entire recorded history of Myanmar.
Which is incredibly notable.
Very. And her personal biography is fundamentally intertwined with the violent politics of the era, yet she orchestrates its most peaceful century.
Her path to the throne is incredibly complex. If you look at the chronology, back in 1423, during the final chaotic years of the war, she was actually given to the court of Ava as a diplomatic bride to help solidify a temporary truce.
Right.
She spent several years living in the northern capital, heavily isolated in a hostile court. But in 1429, she orchestrates a highly coordinated escape back to Pegu.
Her escape is facilitated by two Mon monks who are acting as her religious preceptors in Ava.
Right. They secure a boat, navigate the complex riverine checkpoints, and manage to transport her safely down the Irrawaddy River back to Hanthawaddy territory. It was an incredibly high-risk operation that secured her freedom.
Shinsabu is like the ultimate political survivor. She's treated as a bargaining chip, sent away to a rival kingdom, orchestrates a daring escape, and then outlasts everyone to become one of the most beloved rulers in history.
It's quite a trajectory.
It is. And when she eventually navigates the internal politics of Pegu to ascend to the throne decades later, she presides over a massive economic expansion. If you examine the macroeconomic shifts in Southeast Asia during the mid-15th century, Hanthawaddy's timing was perfect.
The regional trade dynamics had shifted heavily in their favor. To the east, the powerful kingdom of Siam was experiencing severe internal political instability, which disrupted their established trade routes.
So the merchants had to go somewhere else.
Exactly. International merchants redirected their shipping lanes. The ports of Martaban and Pegu became the primary, most stable nodes linking the expanding Muslim trading networks of the Indian Ocean and the Malacca Strait with the interior markets of the Asian continent.
And the volume of spices, textiles, and precious metals flowing through Hanthawaddy customs houses increased exponentially.
Shinsabu leverages this wealth brilliantly. She was treated as a political bargaining chip in her youth, sent away to a rival kingdom, managed to escape, outlived the male heirs, and then utilized her authority to become one of the most effective administrators in the region's history.
Her administrative genius lay in her deployment of religious patronage as a tool of statecraft.
Yes.
She recognized that military force was expensive and often counterproductive to trade. Instead, she utilized Theravada Buddhism not merely as an expression of personal faith, but as a centralizing, unifying state apparatus.
She maintained a profound public respect for the ascetic, forest-dwelling monks of the north, which maintained diplomatic goodwill.
Right.
And simultaneously, she heavily institutionalized and funded Mon Theravada practices within her own borders. By firmly positioning the Hanthawaddy crown as the ultimate patron, protector, and purifier of the faith, she generated absolute ideological legitimacy for her rule.
She unified the population through shared religious identity rather than forced military conscription. You can see the physical manifestation of this policy in the expansion of the Shwedagon Pagoda. Under her reign, the pagoda was transformed from a significant regional shrine into a massive architectural complex.
The scale of it is staggering.
It is. The financial records note that she literally donated her own weight in gold to the project.
Yeah.
They placed her on a scale, measured out 25 viz, which is roughly 40 kilograms of pure gold, and had it meticulously beaten into gold leaf to entirely cover the main stupa.
40 kilograms of gold leaf.
Yes. She also funded the paving of the expansive platform with stone and designed the surrounding landscape, planting specific arrangements of palmyra and coconut trees between the outer walls.
That scale of targeted patronage elevated Pegu from a wealthy trading port into a premier, internationally recognized center of religious learning and pilgrimage. It drew scholars and monks from across Southeast Asia, further integrating Hanthawaddy into the broader cultural networks of the region.
Right.
But perhaps her most astute political maneuver was how she handled her succession.
This is a great point. When she decided to abdicate, she completely bypassed the traditional, often highly fractious nobility. Instead, she turned to the two monks who had risked their lives to smuggle her out of Ava decades prior.
She understood that selecting a successor from the aristocracy would likely trigger a civil war among competing factions.
Because they all want the throne.
Exactly. To prevent this, she devised a method of selection that relied on spiritual providence rather than political maneuvering.
This is the famous rice bowl test.
Yes, precisely. She invited the two monks to the palace for their morning alms. Before offering them their daily rice, she secretly placed a layman's lower garment, a posso, along with miniature, symbolically crafted items of royal regalia into one of the alms bowls.
Okay.
She then made a solemn vow, praying that the monk who possessed the necessary merit and capability to rule the kingdom would receive the bowl containing the regalia.
And the lot falls to Damazetti. The bowl with the regalia went to the monk named Pitakahara. Accepting the outcome, he leaves the monastic order, marries Shinsabu's daughter to solidify his dynastic link, and is crowned as King Damazetti.
And he rules from 1471 to 1492, successfully maintaining and even expanding the prosperity of the Golden Age.
However, the transition was not entirely frictionless. The entrenched nobility of Pigou were initially deeply resistant to Damazetti.
Yeah, they were not happy.
They lodged formal complaints, arguing that he was a man of common blood, lacking the aristocratic lineage required to command their fealty.
Shinsaba's response to this unrest is a brilliant exercise in ideological communication.
She doesn't execute them or threaten them. Instead, she orders her craftsmen to take a common, highly worn wooden floor beam from the palace, a piece of wood that the nobles walked over every single day, and she has it masterfully carved into a sacred Buddha image. She then summons the complaining lords into the hall, points to the newly consecrated statue, and essentially outlines her argument. She says something like, "Yesterday, this common wood was trodden in the dust beneath your feet. Today, it has been elevated, purified, and consecrated, and you willingly bow before it."
By using that specific physical analogy, she demonstrated that authority and sacredness are not strictly bound to origin, but can be conferred through elevation, purpose, and merit.
Which completely dismantled their genealogical arguments.
It effectively silenced the opposition. Damazetti's subsequent reign was marked by extensive administrative reforms, standardizations of legal codes, and a massive boom in international trade.
But history shows that immense wealth, without a proportional military apparatus, creates a highly dangerous vulnerability.
It always does.
While Hanthawaddy was spending decades building gilded pagodas, standardizing religious texts, and regulating customs duties with foreign merchants, a new heavily militarized power was gathering in the inland hills.
And this brings us to the first fall of the kingdom, driven by the Tengu juggernaut, a period spanning from 1534 to 1552.
Right.
The Tengu dynasty was originally a small, landlocked state located in the Setang River Valley. Under the aggressive leadership of King Thaban Shwedi and his highly capable deputy general, Kyaten Narada, who would later become famous as King Beinong Tungu, began a rapid, systematic unification of the upland territories.
And their strategic gaze inevitably locked onto the staggering wealth of Hanthawaddy.
The mechanics of Tengu's expansion were entirely driven by resource necessity. They had forged a highly disciplined veteran army through constant warfare in the dry zone. But to expand further, they hit a hard logistical ceiling.
They ran out of money.
Money and food. They lacked the maritime customs revenue required to purchase the newly introduced Portuguese matchlocks in sufficient quantities, and they desperately needed the massive rice surpluses of the Irrawaddy Delta to physically feed their expanding military machine.
They had the army, but Hanthawaddy had the fuel.
Exactly. And that fundamental imbalance triggers the Tengu-Hanthawaddy War beginning in 1534. Initially, Tengu launches a series of probing dry season raids, testing the southern defenses and retreating before the monsoons.
But the decisive turning point occurs in late 1538 at the Battle of Nanjio.
The Battle of Nanjio is a fascinating study in military mechanics. The Hanthawaddy leadership mobilizes a massive defensive force. The chronicles record an army of 80,000 troops.
That's huge.
While pre-modern numbers are often inflated, it was unequivocally a massive formation. They are heavily equipped with traditional riverine transport rafts and large warboats and a large corps of war elephants.
Right.
They begin maneuvering to link up with their regional allies in the Kingdom of Prome, intending to crush the Tengu invasion force through sheer numerical superiority.
But facing this massive, slow-moving coalition is a much smaller, highly specialized Tengu expeditionary force commanded by Kat and Narata. What occurs at Nanjio is a masterclass in asymmetric warfare and tactical innovation. How does a small infantry force defeat an army equipped with war elephants and river fleets?
By ruthlessly exploiting the enemy's logistical and command rigidities, the Hanthawaddy leadership was demonstrably overconfident. They were relying entirely on their massive numbers and traditional, slow-moving riverine logistics.
Okay.
Kyaten Narata recognized this operational sluggishness. He executed highly disciplined, rapid forced marches, completely bypassing the main river routes to intercept the Hanthawaddy forces at a geographic choke point before they could combine with their allies.
He also utilizes psychological warfare, spreading misinformation through captured scouts to sow division and hesitation among the Hanthawaddy field commanders.
Furthermore, Tumgu forces had deeply integrated the use of early Portuguese firearms into their infantry tactics. While Hanthawaddy possessed firearms, they used them statically, mostly mounted on city walls or large boats.
Like small cannons.
Exactly. Kiawat and Narada deployed matchlock-armed infantry in mobile formations, using concentrated volley fire to shock and panic the Hanthawaddy elephant corps.
And when elephants panic,
it's disastrous. When the elephants panicked and turned back into their own lines, the Tengu light cavalry executed rapid flanking maneuvers, completely shattering the Hanthawaddy command structure. The massive southern army collapsed into a disorganized rout.
Which raises a massive question. If Hanthawaddy controlled the maritime ports, possessed the hard currency, and had direct daily access to the Portuguese and Indian traders, why didn't they monopolize the Portuguese matchlocks?
It's a great question.
How does a landlocked, comparatively poor inland state completely out-innovate a maritime empire in the use of imported weapons?
It reveals the deep systemic vulnerabilities that had developed within the late Hanthawaddy state. They suffered from profound institutional atrophy. After a century of relative peace and focus on commerce, their military structures had become rigid and archaic.
So they were out of practice.
Essentially, yes. Following the death of King Damazeti, the central administration had weakened, leading to dynastic instability and factionalism among the nobility. They certainly had the wealth to purchase firearms, but they entirely lacked the unified command structure and the tactical flexibility necessary to integrate those weapons into mobile field operations.
Whereas Tengu was fighting constantly.
Tengu was forged in an environment of constant high-stakes upland warfare. They rapidly adapted the new matchlock technology to complement their aggressive maneuver-based doctrine. Hanthawaddy relied on static fortifications and fractured political alliances, both of which instantly crumbled when subjected to a concentrated, highly disciplined assault.
And the resulting collapse is incredibly swift. With their primary field army annihilated at Nangyo, the path to the capital is wide open. King Kabachweti advances his forces, and the wealthy, heavily fortified capital of Pegu simply surrenders without a siege in early 1539.
Yeah.
The Hanthawaddy leadership flees and the kingdom falls.
And the Tengu dynasty immediately relocates its capital to Pegu to firmly secure control over the maritime wealth and the delta rice production.
Right.
But the subsequent Tengu occupation of the Mon regions is intensely brutal. The administrative goal was the maximum extraction of resources to fund Tengu's massive, unprecedented imperial campaigns across the rest of Southeast Asia.
The daily reality for the Mon population undergoes a catastrophic shift. The Tengu administration institutes heavy corvée labor requirements. Mon civilians are forcibly conscripted by the tens of thousands to engage in massive infrastructure projects, digging new canal networks and building vast fleets of warboats for the Tengu campaigns against Siam and Arakan.
And the documentation reveals highly systematic methods of demographic control. To prevent mass desertion from these forced labor camps, Tengu administrators physically branded Mon conscripts with tattoos indicating their assigned labor regiment.
That's awful.
Thousands of skilled Mon tradesmen and farmers were forcibly deported from the lush delta and relocated to the arid northern dry zone to serve as elephant keepers and agricultural serfs for the Tengu nobility.
They even went as far as extreme cultural suppression, attempting to micromanage daily life to prevent any capacity for organized resistance.
Yeah, they were very thorough.
The sources detail edicts that banned the Mon population from using mosquito nets, as the authorities feared they could be used to conceal weapons. They were also prohibited from constructing permanent multi-story dwellings, forcing them into easily monitored temporary structures.
It was a highly deliberate, systematic effort to permanently break the economic independence and social cohesion of the Mon people. This intense suppression and systemic extraction of wealth lasted for nearly two centuries.
Two centuries of occupation.
Right. The agricultural and commercial output of the Irrawaddy Delta heavily subsidized the Tengu Empire. But the local Mon population received virtually zero infrastructural or social investment in return.
However, the historical memory of their golden age of Shin Sabu and Damazeti was never fully erased. By the mid-18th century, the geopolitical wheel turns again, As the Tunggu dynasty begins to rot from within, the South rises one final time.
Yeah.
We enter the era of the restored Hampawadi kingdom, lasting from 1740 to 1752.
By 1740, the Tunggu dynasty, which had long since relocated its capital back to the northern city of Ava, is structurally and economically exhausted. Their military has been severely degraded by decades of continuous, highly destructive cavalry raids from the Manipuri kingdom to the northwest.
Okay.
Simultaneously, they're dealing with widespread, localized tax rebellions across their eastern borderlands. The central authority in Ava is visibly crumbling.
Recognizing this structural weakness, the Mon population in Pegu initiates a massive rebellion. They seize control of the local administration. But their first major political decision regarding who will lead this restored kingdom is highly strategic and somewhat counterintuitive.
Very counterintuitive.
They elect a man named Smim Ejitaw Buduketi to the throne.
And what is vital to understand about Smim Ejitaw Buduketi is his specific background. He was not a Mon aristocrat. He was an ethnic Burman, a former monk who possessed direct genealogical ties to the Tunggu royal lineage.
Wait, they install an ethnic Burman king with Tunggu blood to lead a Mon war of independence against the Tunggu Empire. How does that make sense?
It highlights the extreme political pragmatism that defined the initial phase of this rebellion. The uprising in 1740 was not initially driven by strict ethno-nationalism. It was fundamentally driven by shared economic grievances and a unified desire to escape the crushing taxation and labor demands of the Ava court.
So it was more about class or economics than ethnicity at first.
Exactly. By elevating a leader with Burman royal blood, the Mon leadership successfully attracted a highly diverse, multi-ethnic coalition. They brought together ethnic Mons, Burmans living in the Delta region, Karen communities, and Guishan mercenaries.
So it broadened their base.
Right. It allowed them to frame the rebellion not as a racial war, but as a legitimate dynastic alternative to the failing regime in Ava.
And this coalition arms itself rapidly. They leveraged the coastal ports to secure lucrative alliances with French and Portuguese trading agents, acquiring significant quantities of modern flintlock muskets and European artillery, as well as hiring experienced foreign mercenaries to train their infantry.
Yes.
With this modernized force, they quickly consolidate control over the entirety of Lower Burma. Once the south is secure, they push north. In late 1751, operating under a new, more aggressive leader named Binyadala, the restored Hanthawaddy forces launch a massive, highly coordinated invasion up the Irrawaddy River into Upper Burma.
And the military campaign is remarkably swift and effective. By March 1752, the southern armies reach the walls of Ava. They systematically invest the city, breach its defenses, and sack the capital.
Ending the empire.
They capture the last reigning king of the Tunggu dynasty, bringing a definitive end to an empire that had dominated the region for 266 years.
They achieve absolute total victory. But in the immediate aftermath of sacking Ava, the Hanthawaddy leadership makes a strategic decision that rapidly unravels their entire kingdom.
A massive error.
Having conquered the northern capital, they essentially declare the war over. They thoroughly loot the royal palaces, they pack the extensive scriptural libraries, the royal treasury, and the captured nobility onto their river fleets, and they transport all of it back down the river to Pegu.
They withdraw roughly two-thirds of their entire veteran field army back to the south.
They leave behind only a skeletal occupation force, commanded by a general named Taliban, tasked with maintaining control over a vast, highly populous, and deeply hostile northern territory.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. If you analyze this from a basic military perspective, it seems completely irrational. You have just spent massive resources to conquer the capital of the empire that systematically oppressed your people for two centuries. Why on earth would you pack up your army and abandon the territory instead of establishing a durable administrative presence?
It was a fatal miscalculation, and it was rooted in severe geographic overextension and deeply misplaced geopolitical priorities.
Okay.
The Hanthawaddy leadership in Pegu was receiving intelligence regarding aggressive Siamese military incursions into their southern territories along the highly valuable Tenasserim coast. Because their wealth was tied to maritime trade, they prioritized the defense of their southern ports over the arduous task of pacifying the northern dry zone.
Oh, so they were worried about the money?
Essentially, yes. Furthermore, they were operating on an outdated shock conquest paradigm. They assumed that the physical capture of the capital city and the deportation of the royal family automatically equated to the absolute political submission of the entire northern countryside.
And We must examine how that skeletal occupation force interacted with the northern countryside. It is crucial here to note that the historical chronicles from the opposing sides offer varying interpretations of the intent behind these events, and we are analyzing the tactical outcomes, not establishing moral judgments. The documentation indicates that the occupying Hanthawaddy forces, stretched incredibly thin and facing mounting local hostility, resorted to extreme measures. They engaged in widespread, highly visible executions of Burmese elites, local headmen, and Tungu loyalists in Ava and the surrounding administrative centers.
From a tactical standpoint, the Hanthawaddy commanders utilized these brutal reprisals as a pacification tactic, intending to systematically eliminate any potential leadership structures that could organize a counter-rebellion.
Did it work?
No, the empirical outcome was the exact opposite of their intention. Instead of terrifying the population into submission, these actions acted as a catalyst. By vacating the majority of their army and leaving behind a highly aggressive but numerically weak occupation force, they created a massive power vacuum charged with intense political and ethnic resentment.
And the backlash is almost immediate. While the heavily laden Mon treasure fleets are still sailing south towards Pegu, the northern resistance is already coalescing. This triggers the final devastating act of this history. The Kanban resurgence and the final collapse, unfolding from 1752 to 1757.
The epicenter of this resistance is a small northern village called Moksobo. The local village headman, a man named Ong Zaya, refuses to submit to the Hanthawaddy garrison.
Right.
He fortifies his village, builds a heavy wooden stockade, renames the settlement Shuibo, and officially proclaims himself King Alongpaya, thereby founding the Konbaung dynasty.
Alongpaya starts with a highly localized, deeply pragmatic military strategy. He doesn't immediately try to attack the heavily fortified city of Ava. Instead, he utilizes rapid asymmetric guerrilla tactics.
Yeah.
When General Taliban sends isolated small Hanthawaddy detachments into the countryside to demand taxes or enforce submission, Alongpaya's forces ambush and annihilate them in the dense scrub forests.
Alongpaya's military doctrine was the exact antithesis of the late Hanthawaddy approach.
How so?
Well, the restored Hanthawaddy forces relied heavily on fixed, static defenses, slow-moving heavy artillery, and rigid formations of imported foreign mercenaries. Alongpaya built a force based on extreme high mobility, lightly equipped infantry, and sophisticated psychological warfare.
He fought completely differently.
He entirely bypassed the strong points of the southern forces, systematically harassing their overextended supply lines and striking only where they were numerically weakest.
His repeated, highly visible successes against the occupying troops draw thousands of recruits from across Upper Burma. His localized resistance rapidly snowballs into a massive, highly motivated regional army.
It grew very fast.
By early 1754, Konbaung forces successfully besiege and retake the city of Ava, driving the remaining Hanthawaddy forces southward. Down in Pegu, the Hanthawaddy leadership realizes they have made a catastrophic strategic error, and their administrative response is characterized by sheer panic.
Facing a massive, unified northern army rolling toward their borders, the Hanthawaddy leadership abandons their successful multi-ethnic coalition and enacts a series of deeply self-defeating policies driven by intense ethnic polarization.
What do they do?
In a display of panic, they publicly execute all the captive Avon royals they had brought south, including the final Tungu king. More destructively, they issue strict administrative decrees requiring all ethnic Burmans living within southern territory to physically demonstrate their loyalty to the Mon state.
Oh, this is the earrings and haircuts thing.
Exactly. They force them to wear a specific earring stamped with the seal of the Pegu heir apparent, and they mandate that all Burmans cut their hair in the traditional Mon fashion.
It's like Hanthawaddy held a massive sturdy net that had caught all these diverse groups together. But in a moment of sheer panic, they take a knife and intentionally cut out every single string that isn't perfectly mon-colored, and then they wonder why the whole net falls apart.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize the structural failure. The restored Hanthawaddy kingdom achieved its initial success specifically because it operated as a broad, multi-ethnic rebellion against unjust taxation. But by devolving into strict reactionary ethno-nationalism, they shattered their own demographic base.
So the Burmans in the south turned on them.
This catastrophic policy shift caused massive immediate desertions within their own military ranks. Southern Burmans who had been fighting for Pegu immediately defected. Furthermore, it handed Alampaya a unified, highly potent ideological cause. He was no longer just a rebel leader. He was now the sole protector of Burman identity against a hostile Southern state.
Alampaya capitalizes on this collapse of Southern unity brilliantly. In 1755, he launches a massive lightning-fast invasion into the South. The campaign is a blitz.
Yeah.
He shatters the forward Hanthawaddy defenses and captures the crucial agricultural centers of the Irrawaddy Delta by April. In May, he decisively defeats a major Hanthawaddy field army at the settlement of Dagon.
And he renames it.
He immediately renames the captured town to Yangon, which translates literally to end of strife. He now controls the food supply and the river access, but the war is not over. To secure total victory, he has to neutralize the heavily fortified port of Sirium.
And Sirium was the absolute linchpin of Hanthawaddy's survival. It was a deeply fortified, highly modernized port city, heavily defended by French mercenaries and bristling with imported European artillery.
It's a hard target.
The siege of Sirium becomes a brutal, agonizing 14-month stalemate, stretching from 1755 to 1756. Alampaya's light infantry forces, which had been so effective in the open field, simply could not breach the thick defensive walls using traditional assault tactics. They were continually repulsed by concentrated artillery fire.
But the strategic clock is ticking. Alampaya's intelligence networks inform him that fully armed French relief ships, carrying reinforcements, gunpowder, and heavy weapons, have departed from India and are sailing straight for Sirium. If those ships arrive and dock, the Hanthawaddy forces will be resupplied, the siege will break, and the Konbaung army will be trapped deep in hostile territory during the monsoon season. He has to act immediately.
And this necessity forces one of the most intense, vivid tactical operations detailed in the sources, the storming of Sirium on July 26, 1756.
Which brings us back to where we started.
Recognizing that a daytime assault would result in a massacre by the French cannons, Alampaya calls for volunteers for a highly desperate, virtually suicidal night infiltration. Out of his entire army, 93 men step forward. They are designated as the Golden Company.
To give them even a marginal chance of surviving the close-range musket fire in the extreme weather, Alampaya's quartermasters equip these 93 men with specialized gear. They are fitted with thick leather helmets and armor made of heavily layered, hardened lacquer.
The assault is timed to coincide with a torrential monsoon downpour. To mask the movement of the Golden Company, Alampaya orders his main forces outside the walls to create a massive acoustic diversion.
The drums and gongs.
Right. They beat heavy war drums, strike gongs, and play loud, chaotic music, creating the auditory illusion that the Konbaung camp is engaged in a boisterous festival.
Under the cover of the deafening noise and the pitch-black rain, the men of the Golden Company approach the sheer masonry walls. The lacquer armor repels the rain as they use specialized grappling hooks and bamboo scaling ladders to climb the fortifications.
Yeah.
They manage to crest the walls undetected, neutralize the sentries, and move rapidly toward the main gatehouse. They pry open the massive wooden gates from the inside, letting the waiting Konbaung assault force pour into the city.
What follows is hours of brutal, close-quarters, hand-to-hand combat in the flooded streets, systematically neutralizing the artillery emplacements and the mercenary barracks.
It was an extreme tactical gamble, and it succeeded, though the human cost was immense. Of the 93 men who volunteered for the Golden Company, only 20 survived the night.
But their actions decisively broke the 14-month siege. They captured the French artillery intact, secured the port infrastructure, and fundamentally severed Hanthawaddy's vital maritime lifeline.
The timing was incredibly narrow. Mm. Just days after the city falls, the French relief ships finally arrive at the mouth of the river. Unaware that the city has already been taken, they sail into the harbor, only to be ambushed and captured by the victorious Konbaung forces.
Which is a huge win for Alampaya.
This provides Alampaya with an even larger arsenal of modern European weaponry. With Sirium secured and the Delta pacified, the end of the Hanthawaddy kingdom is mathematically inevitable. In May 1757, Alampaya's forces surround and capture the capital city of Pegu.
The subsequent destruction of Pegu was absolute and highly systematic. The massive city walls, which had been originally constructed by the Tungu kings Tabanchuedi and Bayanong centuries prior, were meticulously dismantled and razed to the ground.
Just wiped off the map.
The administrative structures were burned. The Mon's civilian population suffered devastating casualties. Tens of thousands were forced to flee eastward across the border into the kingdom of Siam as refugees. The independent Mon political state, which had defined the geopolitics of Lower Burma for centuries, was permanently structurally destroyed.
When you look at the timeline, it is a truly far-reaching collapse. They went from successfully conquering the northern capital of Ava and seemingly securing absolute regional dominance to experiencing the total annihilation of their civilization in a span of just 5 years.
But if we step back and analyze the broader historical mechanics of this event, it forces us to confront a highly complex question regarding the nature of conquest and the durability of culture.
What do you mean?
Well, the Hanthawaddy political state, its armies, its borders, its ruling dynasty was utterly eradicated. Yet the cultural and administrative legacy of that kingdom profoundly shaped the victors. The architectural marvels they funded, specifically the massive Shwedagon Pagoda, remain the spiritual center of the region. The Konbaung dynasty actively integrated Mon Buddhist scholarship, translated Mon religious texts, and utilized the highly refined administrative, legal, and taxation framework developed by Pagu during its golden age to successfully govern their new massive empire.
The physical infrastructure of their statecraft survived the destruction of their state.
Exactly.
It is a deeply complex reality. If you look at that geopolitical map we discussed at the beginning of our analysis, the sovereign borders of the Hathawadi kingdom were entirely wiped away. The political entity ceased to exist. But the sophisticated cultural and administrative mechanisms they built over centuries simply flowed directly into the foundation of the empire that defeated them.
Yeah.
It forces you to ask, can a civilization truly be considered entirely destroyed if its culture, its religious institutions, and its methods of governance become the very scaffolding used to build the empire that conquered it? It is something to analyze deeply the next time you look at a historical map and assume that the painted lines convey the entirety of the narrative.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.